Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Peanut, and I'm joined on the other line by my good friend, Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Herring. Chris, last night there were no NBA games, and it felt very strange. I'm curious, how did you spend your free time? Did you bake? Did you catch up on any shows? Were you digging into campaigns, pick and roll defense? Just tell the people how you unwound. Tell the people how you relaxed.
It's not weird to me. To me, it's weird when we go weeks at a time without a day of having basketball. I've been trying to do better to step outside of that, you know, as a writer. And this is something that I dreamed of doing, so it's not a problem, but it's nice to have a day where there's not a game, like just to
very nice
to be able to sleep. You were on the road. We were talking about how under the weather you were feeling, like, it, you know, and the players feel that too, and they get breaks, but then they've also got practices. So it's good to have days off occasionally. Not to mention that there are other sports to watch, there are shows to watch, there are movies to watch, there's other things to do. There's time to actually study, which I did use some of the time to kind of study and rewatch things and look up numbers and stuff. But I look forward to the days off. The NBA has kind of started to be NFL itself as far as the off season and not really having downtime and just constantly being in the news. But that's exhausting. It's very fun if you don't really have responsibilities within that, but it's also kind of exhausting to have responsibilities and to feel like you've got to have a take or a feel or a vibe on everything all the time. Like, it's good to just have some room to breathe. And quite frankly, if you're not a big fan of a series, it's probably good for the other side to have an opportunity to really fully adjust and come up with a game plan to try to adjust, which you and I, just before this pod, were talking about how we don't expect that to happen in one of these series, but still, it's nice to have maybe the figment of a possibility that maybe something will happen. So I'm grateful when we have like a stray day off, even if it's mostly done for television purposes.
So you did bake? Did you bake brownies, cookies?
No.
A cake? Is that
I
what
studied
you did?
And I watched Atlanta, which that episode of Atlanta last night was amazing. I don't know if anybody else watched it.
I have not seen the latest. I assume that's the one you were talking about.
Yes.
quick sidebar, since you brought up Atlanta, are you enjoying this season of Atlanta? It's a controversial question these days.
I am. It is interesting that every other week it's kind of like a week, a day, an episode inside the life of white people is basically what they're trying to do, which... It's definitely a different take. The very first episode of the season was very deep, but I was a little bit annoyed that after 4 years off that they went off on a tangent when I think most people just really wanted to know what was happening with Earn and Paperboy and Darius and Van to some extent. So that was a little bit of a turnoff for the first episode, but I'm enjoying it. I think it makes interesting points. I thought the episode from last week, which was about a nanny from Trinidad,
It was such a deep episode
and such a well thought out episode, particularly if you've lived or if you live in New York and you live in certain parts of the city where you have a lot of nannies that are immigrants that come in and care for children that, you know, I guess the whole point of a nanny is to care for a child that's not your own. It just made you think a lot. And I think the episodes this season are doing that. But I can also understand, like, my best friend, I had a get together recently. My best friend, like, went off on how much he does not enjoy Atlanta anymore. He doesn't even watch it anymore. And it presented like a whole full-blown argument that was actually bled into the next day in like our text message thread with the 10 people I had over. So it's very controversial. Like, he had a full-on shouting match with one of my friends that was that had been enjoying some edibles, so maybe that was part of it that fueled it. But yeah, good times at the Herring household. Atlanta, I have enjoyed it, but not everybody has. But it's it was nice to be able to watch that without feeling like you've got to skip away from a game or have to, you know, taking time away from analyzing something was nice. And and also I'm really excited about the WNBA starting today too. I was actually thinking about maybe trying to go to the Chicago game tonight.
Defending champs.
They won a title. Exactly. So I'm thinking about it. Like, I haven't made up my mind yet, but me and one of my best friends went to a lot of games during their playoff run. So I may do that tonight.
For the record, for the most part, I'm enjoying this season of Atlanta. I do think it's a little disappointing. I thought the episode where they just completely eviscerated the fashion industry was one of the funniest half hours of television of all time. That was great. Not so much with the short story vignettes that don't have Paperboy and Earn and all, and yeah, basically what you said, but yeah, you know, those are fun too.
You'll have to let me know what you think of last night's, cause it was okay. Interesting. It involves Paperboy, but it was really interesting with a long lost friend in quotes. That was an episode that made me think a lot, but also was just very funny. But anyway,
just glorious stuff. So, Chris, let's get to the basketball. On today's show, we will be previewing Saturday's game threes between the Celtics and Bucks and the Grizzlies and Warriors. We'll also be opening up the mailbag to answer a few very enjoyable questions. But first, a quick reminder to please keep your emails coming. openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. And I will say, last week, the emails were fire. Lots of them. They were great. We're going to be reading a few on today's show. So thank you to all of you who wrote in and everyone who didn't. Please, we'd love to hear from you. All right, Chris. Let's start with Celtics-Bucks. This series is tied 1-1. And to kick us off, I'm just going to throw it to you. Tell me something you saw in Game 2 or a question you have coming out of it going into Game 3 that really matters and is just on the forefront of your mind, because there are so many plot points in this series. Just where do you want to start?
I think the biggest takeaway from Game 2 leading into Game 3 and the question that it presents is, does Game 3 look more like the beginning of Game 2, or does it look more like the beginning of a Game 3 where, Giannis looked just not happy in the first half of that game. It was obviously a complete 180 from the way they defended him in Game 1. Game, you know, and it's funny, like I watch Reggie Miller and I think we all have our opinions on him as an analyst. The thing he always says, maybe it's kind of like a refrain if and when there are blowouts in games, is like, now if you're Jason Kidd, what you've got to do, you got to find something that works here just to get the opponent's mind thinking about what you might be doing in the next game. You got to find some kind of rhythm, find some kind of takeaway that you could feel good about. He always says that. You look up, and if the score is more than 15 points, you know, the margin's more than 15 points with more than, you know, less than 10 minutes to go. He always says that. So the Boston Milwaukee game kind of had that feel to it. But then Milwaukee had a couple possessions in a row, a good stretch where basically Giannis was getting better looks and the team was getting better looks. Basically, when Giannis was screening for other people, nice. Where they would run screen roll action for him. which does present a different look. Just because, you know, when Giannis was going one-on-one, basically the Celtics were happy to let him do that. So that it meant that the Bucks wouldn't get threes all over the place. That was the big change. The Bucks shot basically fewer threes than not even just them, but just the league that we've really seen in years. The fewest threes made that we've seen in years, certainly on that stage. And that is Milwaukee's lifeblood. And so is Boston going to keep guarding the same way? I imagine that they would, since it shut down Giannis to some extent, or certainly in that first half. But if you're the Bucks, do you start using him as a screener more? And do you start going to other things to try to throw Boston's defense off, since they're looking for Giannis to try to go one-on-one? If he's not going to do that, what does their defense look like? And does it maybe give you advantages in other spots? So that's what I'm looking for, is to see how much of that momentum, you know, in Reggie Miller fashion, does carry over, and how much they could actually take from that game plan wise to try to throw off a defense that really had their number, at least in the first half, first three quarters of game two.
Yeah, great point. I think what's really fascinating, and I'll echo it, is how can Milwaukee generate efficient offense? Their offense in the first two games has been absolutely terrible. Giannis is shooting 38.5% from the floor in this series. And it speaks to his greatness that he can average, what is 27, 11, and 9.5 assists or something like that in two games. And you look at it, look at those numbers, and you're like, wow, he's dominating. And then when you watch the games, it's like, this dude is really struggling. And you got to tip your cap to Al Horford. You got to tip your cap to Grant Williams, who was the star of game two in a lot of ways. Yep. And yeah, they switched up their coverage on him a little bit, you know, less help, fewer double teams, more single coverage, all of that. But what really is fascinating to me is those empty corner screen and rolls, where Giannis is the screener for Grayson Allen or Pat Connaughton or Drew Holiday, and he rolls, and there's no help from the strong side corner, and whoever has the ball is going middle, and the Celtics just basically let them waltz in for a layup because whoever's guarding Giannis is sticking to Giannis. What's fascinating to me about that, which happened, a lot of that success happened when the Bucks were down by, you know, so it's, you can't take too much away. But what's really fascinating to me is who else is on the floor. And most notably, Brook Lopez is not on the floor. Mm. And how does Bud adjust to what is, once again, they won the title last year with Brook Lopez playing a significant role.
Great.
But they escaped the Brooklyn Nets series with Brook Lopez just getting absolutely torched. And I do wonder, right now, with Chris Middleton out, which completely changes the equation for them offensively, how do you get Giannis going? And to me, it's like, you look at the numbers with, and I have them right in front of me here, with Giannis on the floor with Brook Lopez, Milwaukee's offensive rating is 75.9. When Giannis is not on the floor, or when Giannis is on the floor without Brook Lopez, it's 117.1. And Milwaukee's starting five, which is Bobby Portis, Brook Lopez, Giannis, Wes Matthews, and Drew Holiday, they played 19 minutes, and their offensive rating is 69.0. So I just wonder, is Bud going to cut Brook Lopez's minutes? Because the offense has just been so atrocious with him on the court. Defensively, though, he is everything for them. He is so integral to how they want to play. And they've had a lot of success limiting Boston's attempts at the rim. Boston's shooting shot 93 threes in two games. Milwaukee shot 52 threes. Like, that math is just hilarious to me in 2022. But limiting the rim is what they want to do on defense. And if you take Brook off the floor, how does that impact that? Do you see Jaylen attacking the rim more? Do you see Giannis getting into foul trouble because Tatum's attacking the rim more? Are you able to get, you know, lobs to Rob Williams, that sort of thing? So I think, like, this, it's a huge conundrum right now with Chris Middleton out. Do you downsize and just get more spacing, or do you just trust and believe that your defense can carry you for the rest of the series. I don't know what the answer is, but that's what I'm looking for in game three.
It's not a great thing. And I think it gives you, not to jump too far ahead, I think it gives you more appreciation for a team like Phoenix, or maybe not even a team, but like Ayton, which if you're Ayton, you've got to feel really good. Number one, you're about to make a lot of money, bro. Like a lot of money. Aside from that, which I guess being in the NBA always affords you that possibility. For all the crap you've had to hear, and I think I was guilty of it even early on, is that basically, I think the Kings obviously are the team that looks absolute worst from that draft, but Ayton certainly,
yes, they
Bagley,
do.
But then there was Trey, who for a while got that criticism as well, I think a little bit, and Luka, and on how can you pass on a couple guys that could be generational as far as how many times they're all-stars or, the titles they're going to win or whatever else. Ayton is the guy, even Luka within that series, we're watching him kind of get torched because there's no good matchup for him to be had out there. You're targeting him. You can't, the great thing about Phoenix and the great thing about Ayton to some extent is that they're kind of game plan proof as far as it's really hard to play that dude off the floor. Now, when Frank Kaminsky's having to play, and not to knock him too much because I know he's obviously been out this year, but obviously in the finals last year, stuff can get rough when somebody gets hurt, when somebody's out, or when there's just one really bad matchup and it involves someone that you really need on one side of the ball. And it's crazy to think that Brook would be kind of at the root of maybe some of the offensive problems, because in theory that makes sense when you're talking about someone that can't shoot. It's interesting when it's Brook Lopez and it's someone that, if anything, that's maybe become the strongest part of his offensive game and gone away against the grain from what he was as a back to the basket guy, a really slow plotting sort of guy. He's mm-hmm. very skilled, but that, there's still reasons that you kind of need more space just for where he would be if it's going to be the corner, or if a team feels like that they can get away with ignoring him. So
they'll give him the corner. They'll give him the corner.
Yeah, they're going to give you that. And especially if it means that they can have extra hands and arms in there against Giannis. So it's crazy to think like how intricate all this stuff is. I think I even used this in one of my recent stories where you think about watches and all the pieces they have and how much, if I think about the jobs I would never want to have as a person, like a hobby, nothing I would ever want to do. I would never want to have to be someone that has to fix watches, because there's like 8 trillion parts that are all smaller than your fingernail in the back of one. But that's how many parts and things are going into a series at any given moment. And the idea that matchups matter in the playoffs, we know that, but it's crazy to think that someone that is literally half of the reason, sometimes maybe the entire reason, that Boston might struggle to score, and a good game plan based around Brook, largely around him and his length and his ability to just be disciplined at the rim. And to think that he's a really good shooter for his position, and that he could still be potentially played off the floor, that he's potentially a matchup problem that you have to find a way to reduce his minutes because of that. Brooklyn, it makes sense, but I think he's more integral in this series defensively than he might be against a team like Brooklyn, where you just need guys to stop someone like Durant. It's fascinating. And this series is fascinating. I'm very interested to see what happens in game three.
If you're Bud, what do you do, Chris? Because Bud said after game two, I think, that Giannis just figures things out. That's what he does. Yeah. He's a great player. Are you of the mind that, we're using data from 2 games, small sample size, Giannis won't shoot 38.5% for the rest of the series, despite I asked you to answer this question, is this the greatest defense Giannis has ever gone up against? I meant to limit that, filter that to the playoffs, because I didn't want you to do too much research. But, oh, sure. Is Giannis, and I think this is a whole different conversation, but the way we talk about superstars just being able to single-handedly overcome great defenses, I don't think that that's really a realistic way to view stars right now. And when you have a team that has Al Horford, that has Rob Williams, that has Grant Williams, that has Tatum, you can throw on Giannis. So Marcus Smart will switch onto him, and then there will be help, and you can't put the ball on the ground. Like, there's just so many options, so much length. Is Giannis just able, like, to figure this out? Or if you're Bud, are you like, we need to switch something up here? Like, we can't subsist with the lineups that we're playing.
I'll answer. I think you've asked three questions here, and I'll answer all of them.
I'm sorry.
At least, no, it's fine, because some of it was in our outline, so I knew to be prepared for it. First of all, I mean, you know that I've since NBA rank and everything that we did, you know, our SI rank at the beginning of the year, I've had Giannis as my number one player the whole time in the world. I don't, and even feeling that strongly about it, I don't think that you can just like expect him to break through this. I feel better about, for instance, the Warriors and looking at how poorly they shot in game two, saying that I think at least one of those three guys, Poole, Curry, or Clay, will shoot better, because there's more, how would you put it? I think there might be more game to game fluctuation when you're talking about guys that are shooting 25 foot shots than when you're talking about guys that are shooting from inside the paint, that are, you know, that are at the rim or around the rim already. And the reason they're not making those shots has nothing to do with fluctuation. It has to do with really, really, really good physical defenders in their face. So mm-hmm. there's that part of it. So I don't think that it's just a simple saying he always figures it out. Not to be unfair to Giannis, or not to like parse Bud too much here, he hasn't always figured it out. Like, we've seen the Bucks have a series lead before, further along in the playoffs than this.
With Chris lead. Middleton available.
Right.
And Chris Middleton has bailed him out. Not look, Chris Middleton's important and really good, and he's hit some shots.
Very good.
Like, we'll just say
and,
that.
And he would be really important for a matchup like this, as we talk about Giannis being a screener.
Critical.
We're watching a team that, like you said, more or less, you can't take too much from the fourth quarter. I think the Bucks are obviously going to test that and try to utilize it in game three, because it was working. But you have much better odds of something working out if Chris Middleton and Giannis are screening for each other than you do for Giannis and anybody else. I mean, even Drew, yeah, Drew is a good offensive player, but Chris Middleton is 6'8", 6'9", however tall he is, 6'7", whatever he is. He's a big dude, and he's a legitimate, you know, maybe not quite top flight scorer, but he's close, and he has the capability of playing that and pulling that out of his bag in a playoff setting, which we watched him do before. So that's a huge hindrance to not have a guy like that, that you're saying that the team is just going to give Giannis, you know, they're not going to leave Giannis, so that it gives someone like Connaughton a little bit of an open lane to the basket, or Grayson Allen. Okay, if they get that, what the hell is Chris Middleton going to get? If you have to make a decision between whether to guard him or Giannis, and they're both going to the basket at the same time. So that's a huge thing. The last thing I'll say about whether this is the toughest defense, I'm inclined to say yes, but also as we talk about, you know, a time where Giannis did not always figure it out, I don't think at the time we recognized it, but the 2019 Raptors probably were right there as far as how good a defense they were. Now, statistically, did they stack up that well? No, but we were also watching a season where Kawhi Leonard was being monitored pretty carefully as he was coming off of his injury. So he was not playing every game. We also watched Kawhi, I won't say shut down Giannis. It was a lot like this, where he's not as efficient as we're used to seeing him be. I remember watching that series, going back and looking at the box scores, just kind of remembering some of this. He was 1-for-5 in the fourth quarter of the closeout game against Kawhi. Not even just against Kawhi, in that game in the fourth quarter. He was 2-for-6 in the game 3 in that fourth quarter. He was limited to one shot in the fourth quarter of game 4. And he was limited to 3 shots in game 5 in the fourth quarter. So that was a defense that
What research? I am impressed.
So that was a series that had Kawhi at his best, which I remember pulling out. Like, that was the first time I ever referred to him as Terminator. And I don't know if I was the first one to do it. I doubt I was. But just like, Kawhi did not look human, because I don't even think Kawhi was completely physically right in that series either. And there were questions about whether he was healthy at the early part of the series. But just completely took Giannis out of his position where he wanted to shoot in fourth quarters. But it was also a defense that had Lowry, Siakam, Mark Gasol, Serge Ibaka, Danny Green. And oh, by the way, I remember that being the year that me and several other people kind of pulled out the cute statistic of like how well Fred VanVleet had guarded Steph Curry during the season. And I remember watching the film saying like, he looks like he's holding his own against Steph, but even with the numbers, even with the film, feeling like that has to be fluky. Like there has to be something that's just probably a random stat. And then watching the series and watching him do really well against Steph. So Fred VanVleet could very well be an all defensive team player, all defense player this year. I know I put him on my team, on my second team. So that was a great defense that he played against that had a good scheme against him that locked the Bucks down for four games in a row, that locked them up in transition. So I'm not sure Boston's the best defense. I would put them right there with that. But I just wonder, like, we didn't recognize it at the time, but that was a damn good defense that the Bucks were playing against. And that's why I don't feel over because, you know, Middleton was playing in that series. I don't feel great about the idea that that this is just something that Giannis just kind of overcomes because I don't think it's really a him issue. I think it's the defense is really good with a lot of bodies that are capable of absorbing a possession or two off the guy, which is easier for them to do it that way than it is for Giannis to go through them every play, which he still manages to do every now and then, but it's hard.
Yeah, you nailed it. The 2019 Raptors are the team that I think, like, you know, there are a lot of parallels between the 2019 Raptors and this Celtics team in terms of, I guess, just stylistically. You look at the trade deadline move where they bring in a veteran who kind of brings everything together with Gasol. The Celtics bring in Derek White, who struggled. Obviously, different positions, struggled a little bit in the playoffs as well, but just a connective tissue that kind of makes everything easier for everyone when he's on the floor. Superstar offensive player, just a lot of really smart, great defensive talent. Serge Ibaka, did you even mention it? Like he was on that team too, just like a ridiculous roster of defenders. So that's probably, I'd say 1A, 1B, not sure. But the bottom line is that Giannis can't do this by himself. I would not bank on Giannis being able to, quote unquote, figure this out. Do you want Giannis just taking elbow pull-ups over Al Horford? Is that your best offense? Is your best offense him plowing through and trying to, I mean, he can't even, he's not finishing at the rim, let alone, you know, obviously it leaves you at risk for offensive fouls. And Rob Williams as a help defender is just like,
yeah,
like the Celtics aren't going to switch ball screens when Giannis either has the ball or he's a screener. Like they're very disciplined like that. The few times that they have switched, Giannis has taken advantage because he's a great player. So the reason why I picked the Celtics in five was I knew that their offense was going to struggle to a significant degree, regardless of how great Giannis is. I thought that Drew would have to be brilliant. He was very good in game one. He struggled a little bit in game two. And you just like the Chris Middleton is perfect for this matchup. Like,
yeah.
He is the guy who, okay, you're switching everything. All right, well, Chris Middleton's perfectly comfortable going one-on-one, efficient isolation scorer, fine in the mid-range. This is like where he gets his money, is series like this. So to not have him is just such a blow for Giannis, for the Bucks. And frankly, I don't know how they solve it. Because if you do go small, the Celtics have just offensive pieces that'll punish you. And we saw what Jaylen Brown did to Grayson Allen in that one-on-one matchup. So I don't know what you do, honestly, if you're the Bucks. And I don't know if going small is necessarily the answer. I don't think that it'll make Giannis's life easier to the point where that overshadows your defensive concerns because Brooke Lopez isn't on the court. And you're also having Giannis do a lot of stuff on defense. And he's a human being, and he's going to get tired. That's just what it is. So I don't know what you do. So going to be a fun.
I mean, my biggest thought, because I've been like banging my head against the wall trying to think about it. And I mean, you're right. This is why we're not coaches. It's not why, but I mean, I would not want this responsibility to figure out a game plan here. Transition is huge. Obviously, it's hard to come by. It's easier said than done, particularly when you consider that a lot of the transition that you would normally want with this team is Giannis running the break and just getting back before everybody else does, them trying to wall him off and Giannis finding a hole like he often does, or, you know, Euro stepping around someone. I think in this series, you will probably want to run regardless of whether Giannis is really the focal point of the running, just to get open shots, just to get open looks, particularly if they're going to just man Giannis up and other guys aren't getting those shots. Like, this is a team that it's not really clear how they survive on if they can defend Giannis straight up well enough to where they don't have to come off the other guys around the perimeter. You've got to find a way to get threes up. I mean, I've never seen a team basically get outscored 60-9 or whatever it was by threes. I've never seen that. And particularly a team like the Bucks, that normally, if you were to say that, you know, absent the context of like they're playing against the Celtics, that the Bucks were involved in a game where one of the teams got outscored 60-9 from three, I would not guess that the Bucks were the team that got outscored that way. So you've got to find a way just to get more three-pointers up, which means more open shots for everybody and more comfortable shots for everybody. And if that's through transition and it means that maybe Giannis isn't the guy running the break, you have to try something. And, you know, obviously you got to find ways to get in transition in the first place. It's, like I said, it's easier said than done. You have to get some stops defensively. You've got to try to run off some breaks, and you might have to take some shots that feel out of rhythm or out of context just to try to get open ones. Similar to the way that, you know, the Celtics, Ime said, after game one, that it's not a problem for us to get open shots. We've got to be judicious about which ones we're getting. We can force those because we know they're going to give us those to some extent. And that we can rotate the ball enough to get those. It's a really, really big gap when you look at that versus the idea of like what we're talking about with the Bucks with Middleton out. It's just that it's not clear how they get good, comfortable shots other than being in transition. So it's a difficult spot. It's a very difficult spot.
What did you pick? What was your prediction for this series, and how do you feel about it right now?
It was Celtics in seven, which I remember, I think, talking to you about the idea of thinking mostly that Giannis, just thinking that it's Giannis, like to be bold enough to think that Giannis will only get one game or less than that. I can't quite get there. Six, like, to me, was a perfectly reasonable five. I mean, obviously, with the way that the last game looked and the questions that we've got, knowing Middleton won't be back, it's reasonable. I think five or six looks realistic. I think that the Bucks might luck up and hit some shots, or somebody gets hot. Drew gets really hot. Grayson Allen has a game like he had against Chicago. He gets hot. Bobby Portis, something can happen. Boston has another game where they're just off, which I know that was the hope in some ways before, is that, you know, some of these guys just didn't get the shots they wanted, or there were so many open shots that were missed, or, you know, the likelihood of Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum ever struggling to this extent again. What are the odds? It could be five, but I picked seven. I picked Boston in seven. I just felt like it would be too big a hill to climb for Milwaukee without Middleton here, because this feels like a series where Middleton is even more helpful than usual. And I think that's being bore out, but I do think that maybe Milwaukee gets one more game.
Yeah, I could see that happening. I think I'm pretty confident in Boston just being the better team with Middleton out. The 3-point shooting is an interesting variable, as it always tends to be, especially when you're taking as many as Boston has been forced to take. But at the same time, generating 17 corner threes as the Celtics did in game two, typically that's good. Typically that's what you want to do as an offense. I don't know if you're going to make, you know, 8 or 9 as Boston did in game two, but the looks that they get, they're clean, they're open. And it's just tough.
That's why you have to feel good about him, because if that's your floor of like, damn, we didn't score here, but all we got out of it was a corner three. That's not a bad outcome. Like, you just have to knock those shots down. And even as I was thinking about it, like, I remember just watching game one, my thought was, man, the Celtics were too reliant on Al Horford and he didn't get the job done. And then you go back and you look at the numbers and he was like 4 of 9 from three. So I think there's something to be said about like how much of the game is in Al Horford's hands. I remember going back and counting it out. I think he took 5 of their first 10 shots in that game. And I don't know that you ever want so much of it to be in his hands. But, I mean, it's not like the guy went 1 for 9. He went 4 for 9 from three. He wasn't George Nianging this thing. he was shooting well enough to where, like, that is hurting you on some level if you're Milwaukee. You might determine that that's better than letting Giannis run wild for 45. Not pointing fingers at any teams that play in San Francisco. But my point is that, you know, so you might determine that you would rather be beaten by one guy than another. And if you're comfortable with saying, we'll let Al Horford beat us if he has to, if he's willing to try, you can try that, but it still may bite you in some other ways. And to some extent, it's kind of what happened with Grant Williams too, is that, you know, you put the game in other people's hands and they've got a really good guys on their bench and rotation players. And, you know, if they get going, then you're going to start paying more attention to them. And guess who else gets going at that time? Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. So it's a deeper team. And even if the teams were of equal depth, when you take Middleton out of that rotation, it's a much different ballgame. And I just kind of think that's what we're seeing. And the strategy is built for Boston to have more opportunities to score cleanly than Milwaukee. And I think that's the problem.
Let's take a leap on over to San Francisco, shall we?
Sure.
Game three, Saturday night, excuse me, between the Memphis Grizzlies and the Golden State Warriors. This series is an interesting one. Two very entertaining games, yes. I will say that. Let's just start it with, I want to do what we did with the first series here. Just tell me something, Chris, that you've got your eye on, that you're thinking about, questions you have, matchups that are intriguing. Does Dylan Brooks not playing matter? Does GP2 actually, whose absence matters more, GP2 or Dylan Brooks? Just what are you thinking right now?
You want me to start with that one?
Sure, if you want to, go ahead. Yeah.
I think Peyton's absence matters more. First of all, Memphis was like, had like a 1500% winning percentage when John Morant didn't play, which John Morant is not one of the guys out in this game, but they also had a very good winning percentage when Dylan Brooks didn't play. So it's not like they haven't played without him before. It would be very helpful for them to have him. But I mean, between him, they've, you know, last year played a long stretch of the season, most of the season without Jaren Jackson. They played a, you know, third, fourth, whatever this season was without John Morant. They always have good records despite that. So I'm not totally, totally worried about it, although it would be very nice to have him. Gary Payton, on the other hand, him being out of the mix, specifically when you look at how he's guarded and how he's done guarding John Morant statistically, the matchup data on NBA.com looks like 4 of 18. That he shot this season with more turnovers than he's had assists when Gary Payton II is guarding him.
Who is one of the best defenders, full stop, in the NBA.
Hands down. So, I mean, the reason that matters without, you know, having to belabor it is for how good that defense is, I don't think they've got a whole lot of great guys to guard the wings, the smaller guys. You know, Draymond obviously can do it. I don't know if I would really trust him or want him to try to take on something like that with Ja. It's a much different assignment than someone like Jokic or something like that. No. You don't want to burn him out doing that. Even if you could do that, I'm not sure you would want to, or if it's a good matchup. So, I mean, that it's huge for that reason, because he's hands down the best guy for that job. So I think that's more meaningful than Dylan Brooks. if you're getting back to the initial questions you asked, of just kind of like similar to the last series we talked about, what questions are you thinking about? I'm not going to overcomplicate it. When will Golden State shoot better? Because you know that they will. And I remember having a big debate with my best friend about the last series against Denver. And when they were up 3-0, I was like, oh, I'm almost positive they just closed it out today. And he's like, you're that confident? Like, it's really difficult to keep up the shooting streak that Poole has had. And, you know, at some point they're going to come back down to earth. I was like, it doesn't have to be in this series. You know, and so of course that game Denver won after Poole cooled off. They almost won the, I don't remember how close that game five was, but you know, so he was right about that. But the reality now is like, okay, Klay has been shooting poorly for a couple games now. I can't remember a game where all of the Splash Brothers or two of the three shot as poorly as they did in the last game. And now we're talking about Dylan Brooks being out for this game. So I imagine that at some point someone will get it going. And because of how close the games have been, if anybody does, that might be enough to tip the balance. The other question, which might be even bigger than when do the Splash Brothers find water again, is like, is Steve Kerr going to actually start coaching better, which seems a little bit harsh, but like, damn, bro, how many points does John Morant have to score on your defense one-on-one before you start to say, let's do something else here? It's a really slow adjustment. I will be the first one to say that as much as I just criticized him, I don't know that I would start the game throwing a second aggressive help defender at him or doubling him, because I don't want Bain or Zaire Williams or anybody else to basically get off at the beginning of the game. I would probably wait until the second quarter to do that. But at some point, like, you can't let somebody just blitz your defense for 45 unless it's a winning strategy for you. You could probably get away with that in the Phoenix series against Doncic. I don't know that you can get away with that here. Like, look at how poorly the rest of the guys shot. Jaren Jackson fouled out in what, less than 28 minutes? Dylan Brooks got ejected. Like, what are we talking about here? Like, you cannot let one dude beat you when the other best player, and Bain is hindered. Like, he has not been himself. He has not looked that good offensively. So what are we even talking about here when you're losing a game to someone that is basically Michael Jordaning you because you're letting him? It's not to take anything from Ja, like, he was brilliant, but I'm just saying you can't let someone just be that brilliant when the rest of his teammates are struggling that badly or not even in the game and let them beat you. Like, it's kind of inexcusable from where I sit. So that's my thought, is just, will Golden State shoot better, which they will at some point, and will Kerr start putting a second man anywhere near Ja Morant so that he can't just do what he wants to?
Yeah, I 100% agree with everything that you said. Steph Curry is going to shoot better. We're also going back to the Chase Center.
And that too.
Huge, being at huge home. FedEx Forum is an unbelievable environment, and it is tough to win basketball games there. So we'll get that out of the way. But Steph's going to shoot better. You would imagine Klay's going to shoot a lot better. Dylan Brooks not being available. Yes, they had a lot of success during the regular season without him when he had that bad high ankle sprain, but he is their guy to guard Steph, and absolutely, he does a pretty good job guarding Steph, as good as anyone can do, as has been seen in this series even, in just limiting good looks.
He was 0-7 in game one, right? Or something like that, when Steph was the when he was the closest guy to Steph, primary right. guy. Yeah, you're right.
So you see his absence felt by, there were stretches in game two where Ja is just guarding Steph as the primary defender. And I was just like, what's happening here?
Right.
And it's tricky because, like, where are you going to hide Ja? And that's just a whole different, we had that conversation in our last episode about his defensive woes and how you need to attack that, which they did a little bit in game one, couldn't really do that much in game two. But anyway, yeah, like, the Steve Kerr thing is really, really interesting to me, because we're talking about a top 15 all-time coach, multiple time champion, been around the league forever. And it was just curious to see them go to the same It was almost like we saw a little bit of it in the first round when the Memphis Grizzlies went like super duper small and they had shooters around Ja, and they had one big Brandon Clark as the role man slash I'm going to try to punch every single offensive rebound out to the perimeter.
Right.
That was like their strategy. That's not who they are. That's not their identity at all. They had success with it in that series. They closed because Jaren Jackson Jr. fouled out in game two, super small. And you're just, it's like the same play over and over and over again. Either they're going to screen whoever Jordan Poole is guarding up to, they're going to bring him up into the ball screen action. Or Brandon Clark is just going to come up and set a flat screen, and Ja's just going to pick which way he wants to go. And guess what? He goes left every single time.
Yep.
And he scores. And it was just like, I get respecting Desmond Bane, who, by the way, I'm going to just quickly plug a story that I wrote today's daily cover on SI.com about Desmond Bane, leads the league or leads the postseason in made threes. And despite going 2-for-9 in the series, in part because of a hampered back, is still incredible and not to be left alone. So I understand that for sure. But at some point, you got to put extra bodies in the paint and you got to run out to the 3-point line and contest shots. Like, the playoffs are hard. You don't have Ja Morant just kind of dipsy doing his way below the free throw line. And then, Draymond Green's going to come over and provide some help when the ball's already in the air. So
yeah, man, and Ja's going to jump a lot higher than Draymond, like no shade, but like I'm not used to, Steve Kerr has been out coached before. It's not like it can't happen. I still remember getting into it with a radio host out in the Bay when I said that about Ty Lue, and he was like, you're saying it like Ty Lue is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I was like, I'm not saying that, but he's a damn good coach. And it was so weird to me the way he like challenged me on it. I was like, you can say that he outcoached somebody to end a series. It's happened before. It happens with the greatest coaches we've ever seen. We've seen Pop make mistakes and get outcoached in spots. It happens. It's not the end of the world. But it's weird to see it take place for a whole game when, again, I mean, you know, Zaire was great. I mean, he hit a lot of outside shots. But aside from him, there just wasn't much effectiveness from a lot of these guys to where you're going to be so attached to them, particularly when Jaren Jackson's out, particularly when Dylan Brooks is out, particularly when Bane has not been himself. It's just kind of a little bit inexcusable to the point where I would not expect to see it again. If you're the Warriors, you have to take care of business now that you're at home, now that you have an opportunity to kind of set the tempo a little bit more playing at your home place. So we'll see, but it just, it's a series. Like, if I'm the Warriors, I don't want to mess around with the series. I just don't. It's a team that has enough talent to really push you. I figured that the Warriors, just being the Warriors and all the veteran experience they have, would kind of push them through for a lot of this and get them through this series. I picked the Warriors in six. But if they mess around and go seven, like, anything could happen, just like we saw with the play-in game last year when they lost to this team. So, you've got to be feeling good if you're Memphis. If you're Golden State, I guess the glass half full interpretation of all this is that you've not played all that well, given your potential and what you think of yourself, and that you did win the first game and that you could have won the second game despite playing that poorly. So that there, I mean, obviously it would not take much for them to kind of regain the advantage in the series, but game two was kind of eye-opening for a few reasons.
Zaire Williams shot 32.5% from the corners this season, and he's like 15 years old. Like, I'll just never get over that. I know he's like 50% in this series from deep, 4-for-8, but like, I'll just like never get over it. And it feels like we're taking something away from Ja. The man scoring 47 in a playoff game against one of the best defenses in the league, like, incredible. So like, some of the shots he hit were against single coverage or whatever, but like, they're still tough floaters. Like he's hitting floaters that are off balance. Like just he's amazing. So I don't want to don't let anyone.
It's not diminishing it. It's because it, I mean, the other thing is like, look at the gracefulness with which he finishes, which is part of why it wasn't shocking, but it was still you in game one, you kind of expected that first, that last shot to go down on some level. Just because we've seen him do it so many times. Now he was going 80 million miles an hour, trying to shoot over two people. So with his left hand, this is not easy, but like we've gotten used to seeing him make these acrobatic shots before. So no, by no means is it easy, but if you're the Warriors, you have to make it a lot more difficult for him than what he's seen defensively. And again, I think a little bit inexcusable that they haven't done more, which that's on Kerr. You know, it's a team that has enough smarts to be able to, you know, set up however Kerr's asking him to do, but it just has not looked great considering how shorthanded Memphis has been at times within their rotation.
Let's open up the mailbags. We've got some emails real quick that I want to cover that have to do with Ja, have to do with the Grizzlies, have to do with Luka. I want to get to those questions real quick. So the first one comes in from Kevin. This email made me smile because it included screenshots and video evidence. Kevin writes, "Hey guys, I have no horse in this race, so please don't take this as a quote, my team should have won end quote complaint, but here's my complaint. Have there ever been two more egregious uncalled carrying violations than Ja Morant in the final 30 seconds of games one and two? One turned into a turnover in Golden State one, one turned into a layup in Memphis one, but I've never seen anything like this in a league that is known for not calling carrying violations." And our listeners cannot see the footage, the screenshots, the blurry Zapruder film footage that that Kevin supplied in his email, but he finishes out just saying, "It's a good thing these games are close and compelling because this officiating has been a disaster." The NBA acknowledged this in their two-minute report, saying on one of the turnovers or non-called carries, quote, "Morant places his hand completely under the ball and brings it to a pause during his drive to the basket. That should have been a travel." So I don't really have a lot to say about this. I just wanted to read the email and thought it was funny. Like, Chris, do you have any issue with like carrying and how Ja manipulates the ball and just stuff? I personally do not. I don't. Yeah, sure. You're not supposed to do that and you shouldn't do it. But like, I don't know. Is it giving him that much of an advantage? Maybe it is. And maybe I'm just an idiot, but I don't know.
My thing, hopefully it's not too much of a cop out. Okay. If that's what you think, or if it's a problem, I really highly doubt Ja just started doing it during the playoffs. It would be kind of, it would be kind of disingenuous to just start calling it in the playoffs. Now, if you're going to make an issue of it, then you make an issue of it during the off season and you address it and you start calling it more during the game so that then you don't see it at this time of year. It's not Ja's fault. And like, I can appreciate that the person that wrote in is saying that he doesn't have a horse in the race anyway. Because I feel like I did see a lot of Warriors fans kind of breaking down the stuff the same way. And I'm just kind of like, I'm not saying don't be that guy, but I think what I'm saying more is like, I don't think that's on Ja. Like if there's something that Harden is doing that is getting more attention, generating more. It's getting more attention because we're all watching the same two games every night.
Watch Kevin Durant's crossover dribble. I don't mean to single him out, but like he carries every single time.
Yeah, and I feel like Iverson. Like I just kind of feel like there've been plenty of guys that you're probably not one of the league's niftiest ball handlers if you're not doing something that manipulates some sort of rule a little bit. I don't have a ready-made list, so it's just kind of more me thinking that, but I guess my issue, if anything, would be like, okay, this is annoying me personally. The league should probably address it when there's a stoppage in play during an off season and then address it that way. And then maybe it's cleaner, but to my untrained eye, just watching it, it doesn't look crazy. But then again, untrained eye, like a lot of times it takes replays to see some of what people are talking about. It takes slowing stuff down to see what people are talking about. I don't know. I don't know how to feel about it, but I did not have a strong opinion about it at all during the game, after the game, when people were tweeting about it. Like I was just,
I didn't even know it was a thing until
I was enjoying jaw dropping like 90 points on this defense. So I didn't care, but I can recognize that other people see it and they're, you know, to some extent. Who was it that what's his name from the guy that shoots the free throws underhand? Rick Barry, when he was complaining about it was a couple months ago, but he was complaining about how people don't call, the guys don't get called for traveling anymore. Maybe he was talking about carrying. I think he was talking about carrying specifically, if I remember. And so it was interesting because on the one hand, he was saying he still loves the sport, but he was saying we didn't get reffed this way. Like, we would have gotten called for this. So there was truth to what he was saying. For me, I think I lean more heavily, like, I could acknowledge there's truth in that. Probably is doing something that's a little bit against the spirit of the rule with the caring stuff, but I'm going to enjoy the game. And if the league steps in eventually, like maybe they should, great. But we know it's not going to happen now. So it's kind of like wasted conversation for now, at least in the grand scheme of things now, is how I feel.
My advice real quick before we get to the email is just understand that all bad calls are even at the end of the day. Like, it's all on balance. No team is getting screwed by the officials. There are bad calls both ways. Just watch the basketball. That's all I have to say. You will enjoy the NBA more if you do not worry about every single whistle and every single foul. And it is exhausting to talk about this. There are still people in the media who care so deeply about it. I feel bad for people who do. Just watch the basketball. It's okay. It's wonderful. Just enjoy it. It's like, don't let the officiating mar every single playoff game. It's a big deal. It's a huge factor, but it's all on balance, in my opinion. And that's how I choose to see it, because I need to sleep at night. Okay. So our next email comes in from Steven, who writes, I reject your Ja Trey defensive comparison because Ja clearly cares. He just isn't good. Trey knows he sucks on defense, so he just lets it happen. As a side note, if Desmond Bain and Kawhi Leonard got into a snatch the ball contest, who would win, or would the ball pop? Great email, Steven. I stand by everything I said about the defense with Ja and Trey, and we don't need to get into that again. They're both liabilities. The end. If you're a liability, you're a liability. I don't know what to say. I'll just say about the snatch the ball contest, I guess a jump ball tie up situation, the ball might pop. Sure. I've shaken both of these men's hands before in my life. And I will say, Kawhi's hands are obviously ridiculous, and I didn't even see my hand, and I looked down at it when I was shaking his. I couldn't even see my own. So that just, like, Desmond Bain's hands aren't really that big. Obviously, he's a little like bodybuilder body type. I will say his hands are, I hope this doesn't sound too weird, they're very like, they're like loaves of bread. They're like thick. His hands are huge, but not long. Does that make sense? Like, they're really wide hands, unnaturally. I don't really know where I'm going with this, but after shaking his head, I was like, I can't even get my hand around. Like, it's NBA players' hands are fascinating to me. It's a whole thing.
I think you're subconsciously saying that Kawhi would probably break the ball faster. Because okay, I don't know if wide hands would help you, like, help you burst a basketball faster, but maybe wide hands. Like, I don't know. Like, then again, I guess you didn't really offer a verdict on, like, stronger. I've had people that shook my hand. I'm like, okay, I didn't need you to fracture my hand in the midst of a handshake. So I don't know if either one of them did that to you. But yeah, Kawhi's hands are bigger, and maybe you weren't saying that because wide, I guess, is a different type of size description. I don't know. I for some reason, between that and, again, maybe I just kind of associate, and there was the commercial that associates Kawhi with the Terminator too. Maybe that's, I just think Kawhi,
I think he'd win too. Kawhi would win,
yeah,
or the ball would pop. Just great stuff. Great email. Really thought provoking.
The handshake analysis was like worth the price of admission for this podcast, which I know is free, but still, like, even if it, you had to pay, that would have been worth it.
All right. Let's close with this email from Manuel. I thought it was really interesting. It's about Luka. Hey guys, hope you're doing well. As a European NBA fan, I became a Mavericks supporter in the Dirk Nowitzki era. In a perfect turn, rarely seen in the real world, the Nowitzki era ended just when another European took control of the franchise, so my fandom was perfectly fine with Luka Doncic. But now I feel that I lost a good part of my enthusiasm. Doncic is great, a generational talent, but I feel that he has lost something along the way. His astronomically high usage, his ISO heavy way of playing, is being exposed by a team-oriented squad like the Suns. Aesthetically, it's far from ideal. I didn't want him to become a better version of James Harden. And also, I think that style of basketball has a ceiling. It's very difficult to win big like that. Do you think that his style is derived from a lack of surrounding talent, or this is who he is, a heavy usage guy? Sometimes I feel it is kind of hard to watch him dribble and dribble and dribble until he finds a favorable matchup and then launch a contested three. Keep it up, the great work. Manuel, thank you so much for this email. And I guess I'll just say off the top, I like emails like this because I can't even envision a version of Luka that isn't just high usage, heliocentric. I'm just going to run a pick and roll on every play and make a decision, and it's probably going to be a really good one. But it is interesting. This email made me think about, like, what if Luka was, like, not in a system like that where, you know, the ball is popping, he's locating off the ball, he's setting screens, he's doing all these other things. And we really don't even consider that possibility for him. And obviously he's just at the dawn of his career, and who knows what pieces are going to be put around him over the next 10 years, next 12 years, and how he's going to play. But I thought that this was really interesting in that vein. And to directly answer it, I'll say that, like, their strategy is fine offensively, in my opinion. Like, you just need guys to hit shots, and Luka is, there's only so much you can do against this Phoenix Suns team, and Dallas is not the Phoenix Suns. So they're kind of built around Luka in this way where, yeah, he has to run high pick and roll, and he has to do X, Y, Z on every single possession offensively, but he's up to that task and he's that talented. Defensively, it's a whole different question, and we don't need to really get into that right now. But what did you make of this email from Manuel, Chris?
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for having so much have to go through this one guy. It probably should not be that surprising that everything kind of has had to. Obviously, when they went to go get Porzingis, that was part of the effort, was to try to make it so that it could be a two-man show instead of one. We found out that really wasn't, you know, I don't know that that was going to lift their ceiling, certainly with the cap requirement for him. So on some level, it's, you know, they just haven't had the second guy. Now, Brunson at times can do that. It's kind of a your turn, my turn sort of thing, but it's still sort of the same offense, really. But look at the other guys. Trey was more or less that until they really built the roster more around him last year. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of a top end of the draft sort of thing that when you're a bad team, it's going to take a while to build that out. And then because of the way NBA offenses work right now, when you've got a guy that is such a good scorer and such a good passer, the quickest way to build the team out without really needing a max level guy is, like, let's just get a bunch of shooters. So it kind of lends itself to being that way. But the truth is, Harden's career looked like that too. Once he went to Houston, they started building around him in that way. Then we all were kind of really curious when they sent Chris Paul to Houston. I mean, they did give him Dwight first, but Chris Paul went there. We were like, oh, what's that going to look like? That's going to be crazy, because, like, all we've seen Harden do is basically score, because he's had to. And so then we saw a second guard go there, and a guy that had every bit of the skill that James Harden had. And we watched Harden freed up on some level as a scorer. We watched him more freed up as a passer. We watched them be able to trade off and get really close to winning a championship that way. So stuff would absolutely change. We watched KD go to Golden State, obviously, to be basically be able to sometimes play like a role player if he wanted to within an offense that was built around Steph Curry. We watched LeBron go to Miami. So the truth is a lot of guys go through mid-career shifts as far as what's asked of them. LeBron was a much bigger scorer during those Cleveland years, I think, than even he really wanted to be because he had to. So Luka is absolutely young enough to where we'll see some of those changes happen, whether it's because of the organizational changes that Dallas makes or because, you know, God forbid Dallas only win this one series over the course of Luka's time there, he'll get up and go somewhere else. Which that escalated very quickly. Yeah, I didn't mean to hint that that's going to happen, but I'm saying, like, at a certain point, guys do eventually kind of decide to leave if they feel like they've had to do too much, which is part of what makes Harden's situation so interesting with the Brooklyn thing. Is like, that was why he went there, was to not have to do everything, to play in a system where he had other guys, where he could be part of a group where you can kind of not have to have it all on your shoulders. We haven't seen Luka exist in an environment like that before. So yeah, his play style on some level, maybe it's not always the most enjoyable, but maybe that's partly him. Maybe he likes it that way. It'd be fascinating if somehow like Luka played, I don't know, if Luka somehow, like, just thinking about Golden State and how much they changed when Steve Kerr got there, you orchestrate that offense differently. You ask guys to do different stuff within that offense. It's possible, but, you know, a lot of that is who your coach is. A lot of that is who your teammates are. And a lot of that is whether you have a guy on your team that is anywhere near as talented as you to where you're comfortable not having to have the ball. And then what do you do when you're off the ball?
Yeah, well said. One other star you didn't mention who did a fantastic job adapting his game was Russell Westbrook this year with the Los Angeles Lakers. Just folded right in, embraced a new role. Was brilliant doing it. And so I just want to, we got to give our kudos to that too.
You said Russell Westbrook folded. Damn. I'm not even going to say anything, bro. That was wondering all right. Where you were going with that. I was like, wow.
All right. Yeah. I think that's a great place to end today's episode. Thank you, Chris, for your expertise, your insight. Thank you so much to our listeners. Please keep your emails coming to openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Everybody, please stay safe. Everybody, enjoy the NBA playoffs.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.